You are listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource, and we are grateful to all of our listeners who help keep us the podcast going by donating to the show. We are also grateful and proud to be supported by the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies.
Welcome to episode 62, where we discuss the 2008 movie WALL-E, directed by Andrew Stanton and produced at Pixar Animation Studios. We will be using the movie to discuss how it exemplifies a number of concepts and ideas from organization studies and management science. This is part one of the episode, which we've subtitled, Talking About Organizational Behavior and Leadership Through Film. Hi, this is Tom, calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Pedro, coming to you from Lyon in France on a beautiful sunny day.
Hi, this is Michael from a rainy Utrecht in the Netherlands.
And this is Ralph coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico in the high desert. Today we're going to talk about the American computer animated science fiction film WALL-E that was produced by Pixar Animation Studios for Walt Disney Pictures. WALL-E has minimal dialogue in its early sequences. Many of the characters do not even have voices, but instead communicate with body language and robotic sounds. The movie was commercially successful and won several awards. In the movie, Earth is depicted as an abandoned planet covered in toxic waste and trash arising from decades of mass consumption facilitated by a megacorporation called By and Large. Unable to restore the ecosystem, By and Large devised a radical approach to evacuate Earth's population using automated outer space cruise ships, whilst Trash Compactor robots called WALL-E, which is an acronym for Waste Allocation Load Lifter Earth Class, works to cleanse the environment until signs of life are restored.
Now, perhaps our listeners are wondering, what does this have to do with organization theory and management science? But when you consider all of the characters and the depictions and the environment, there is so much commentary in terms of social and organizational that it's worth really exploring. And I just want to use the By and Large Corporation as an example. WALL-E is full of social commentary, and the By and Large Corporation sort of represents what I think is a future environment where today's consumerism, today's desire to, you know, basically buy your happiness has run completely amok, which ultimately runs into the problem of trash and the earth being becoming a dump. And By and Large Corporation is essentially the primary enabler in it. It's sort of modeled in a way after Walmart on steroids, because it makes reference to ultra stores, large, huge, unbelievably massive consumer outlets. But it also kind of gets into, corporations getting into public service, because there isn't a single thing that was in the scene, the early scenes where WALL-E the robot is dutifully doing his job cleaning the earth, where you don't see By and Large logos plastered on everything from the public transportation, shipping. It's a depiction of not just a large corporation, it's a depiction of a total monopoly of which, ordinary social controls clearly fail.
By and Large becomes the dominant, if not the only, seller or vendor or merchandiser. And as you said, not only are they selling products, but they're selling happiness as well. And maybe that's the subtext of the sales today.
So I'm listening to this, and my first impression when I watched the movie was exactly this kind of, common trope of the large corporation that in this case, it becomes so big that it takes over everything. So it's a traditional commentary of the dangers of corporativism and misconduct of organizations, or just, capitalism in general. But at the same time, I think what becomes interesting is that when we learn about life outside Earth, on how these people have been for centuries in these giant spaceships and are all living there, it looks very much as a life in a community, you know, because we don't see, I mean, they don't work for one. There's not seems to be any kind of exchange of money, you know, they seem to live in that bubble for many, many, many centuries. So at the same time, while it seems that this big corporation is like the super face of capitalism on steroids, and I agree, I think the Walmart is like the hidden example here. At the same time, it seems that once life leaves Earth, and then all this, you know, once the planet is no more, all this logics kind of becomes different because, you know, everyone is just trapped together and in a way lives together, and all the different systems of exploitation, of differences, kind of erode. So you just found humans in a spaceship. Am I the only one?
Reacting on your traditional commentary remark, Pedro, in a way I see it actually as another level of a dystopian worldview, right? So yes, it is a commentary on capitalism and consumerism, but the whole idea that this super mega corporation is taking over public services, taking over government, taking over military, they're doing all kinds of operations, Operation Recolonize and these kind of things. The question that popped in my head was like, where is government, right? It's not nowhere in this movie. And I don't come across that many movies where the public authority is actually not present in the viewing.
If anything, I remember that in the movie there is, you know, the message that the captain receives from, you know, many, many centuries before when the spaceship departed. And it's, if I remember correctly, on the video that he watches, there is someone that is standing on what looks like a very governmental space, you know, with the traditional US seal behind him. But of course, instead of the US, it is the by and large corporation there. But the setting looks exactly what we'd expect.
True. He is the global CEO of by and large, indeed. And the whole setting gives this governmental or public perspective. But then it's still the global CEO. Yeah, it's a very interesting way of playing with alternative world perspectives that, in my view, are not something we should wish for, of course.
Yeah, that's a good point. I agree with both you guys that symbology of being on the blue stage and with a seal was very reminiscent of U.S. presidents or U.S. official spokesmen. And I think it reflects, as Tom was talking about, this merging of governmental authority and consumerism and those kinds of things. But as Michael pointed out, it's for, I think, for dramatic effect or for an artistic effort that they're trying to put together. So it makes you think about those things. And I think Michael wins the prize for being the first one to use the word dystopian in the recording.
Thank you.
Well done. And it's funny. I think it's dystopian with a smiley face on in some ways, because you don't see the human suffering. I said that just for you, Pedro. You don't see the human suffering, really, as in a lot of dystopian worlds like The Island or something else. And in this particular case, it takes, instead of in the Star Trek world where people don't use money and food just shows up and those kinds of things, in this case, they just watch TV all day or go around their screens or talk about golfing and such. Nobody's actually trying to study organizations or plant matter or grow anything. And you don't see any of the humans in the robot workshop, or you actually don't see humans doing work at all, which is interesting.
Which is also kind of a reflection of what some people might consider to be happiness, because you look at, for example, the original promotional videos for life in space that were depicted early in the movie, saying, you know, this is what life is going to be like on one of these space cruise ships. And they all seem to be enjoying the fact that they have all of this freedom, all of this autonomy. It's not until we see centuries later that you have the after effects, which I agree. I think there's a certain dystopian view to it. And so in a lot of ways, you almost see like two different types of dystopia rooted in the same thing of the total control, the merging of private and public. But basically, you know, from the people who are living there, the one corporation is, you know, everything, provides everything and determines everything. And it's reflective of contemporary conversations about, you know, sort of like the tension between what's appropriate for government to provide what makes it right for the government to provide something versus what is right for a corporation to provide? Because that's never a clear black and white distinction, because we seem to, people seem to prefer the public sector, the reliability that a good, strong public sector provides versus the choice and the freedom that a corporate entity would provide. So there's a constant balance between the two that we realize in society. And we're almost seeing, like, in two different environments and two different ways. The challenge is that if you will remove that tension and it all becomes one, it doesn't necessarily produce a good result.
Right, or what you might call human flourishing. And I think that's one of the reasons why they collapse the two, but I'm not sure. It certainly helps them make their artistic point about hedonism and what people focus on, and taking the cruise ship metaphor where you don't do anything and you're pampered and you have the robots massaging you and those kinds of things, and removing that whole idea of organizations and work and what people do. And I think one of the things that's useful about this is it allows you to focus on just a few parts and not everything all at once.
So on this issue of government and private corporations, it's certainly cultural, and it's, I think that the film is set in the U.S. is, of course, appropriate because, I think that traditionally the U.S. context is one in which the state has traditionally been very small, and there is resistance toward what the government do or whatever. But what I wanted to expand is on, Tom talked about autonomy, Ralph talked about hedonism. So going back to my previous point, the thing that I keep trying to understand is that, if you were to do a Marxist reading or a Marxist type reading of the movie, and exactly, now we are in the spaceship and everyone's together, there is this communitarian, but it's not the community of, of an idealistic Marxist world in which people have now ownership of the means of production, they have ownership of their outputs, and then they can enjoy their creativity and work thus becomes a source of fulfillment. But it's exactly what you're just saying. There is no work anymore. And also, in a way, it's dystopian, because what seems to be what is central for humanity, being able to do something, practice, do an activity and see that and feel fulfilled, doesn't exist anymore. So it's a different way in which you end up in a communitarian, homogeneous, pleasant, hedonistic world, but you have very much removed maybe what is a defining characteristic of being human.
And that's a great point, because I think if you don't have work, does leisure have meaning? And if that's what you do all the time, and as you said, Petra, is that part of what makes us human? In fact, in the early part of the movie, the one who's human is Wally, because he has work to do, and he's very dedicated to it. And you can think of him as a small cog in this large machine, and he's just laboring away. But he's dedicated to accomplishing his mission and continuing day after day. And there's that scene where you see in the micro level, he's compacting the trash. And then later you see him he's filling up some foundation in one of those trash pyramids or trash skyscrapers.
Yes, the movie really transfers the labor from humans to robots. And it's specifically Wally we see doing the work on the cruise ship. Or the spaceship, we see all these other computers also doing all these types of work. Whereas humans, they've become docile bodies, but maybe even docile consumers. I think there's something interesting at the case, looking from the Marxist point of view, that it's not the labor, but it's the consumerism that has become the instrument of capitalism in this sense, to an extreme. Humans are still being exploited by capitalism, you might say, but then in a different role, a role that we already play probably in current society, but then in the next level in the movie.
Right, and I think there are many people from the Marxist persuasion, but others as well, such as critical theorists, who argue that our free will as consumers is perhaps an illusion or limited, or we're transformed by that consumerism. And I think that that observation about the docility is spot on, Michael, because there's a couple scenes in there where the advertiser is saying, try these new clothes. That blue is the new red. And magically, everybody's clothes transform. They actually don't have to push a button. It just happens. And there's a couple of really interesting scenes where Wally causes a traffic jam in the express area of the hover lounges, or somebody reaches, puts their hand up for something to eat, and it doesn't. Their hand doesn't get filled, and they're shocked. They're surprised. It jolts them out of that worldview.
What I found interesting, you know, thinking about especially consumerism and, you know, this more critical reading, is that especially in movies, we are used to see a villain, you know, and a traditional story here could be exactly that there would be someone or something behind the system that has been created. But I think the strength and the great social analysis is to show that there is no Wizard of Oz. There is no one behind the curtain. In a way, the system has evolved in such a way and has reproduced itself and has created all this dystopian future in which exactly people are still consuming and see themselves only through that and in that. But there is no big capitalist exploiting or selling anything. We don't see that. You know, it's just the operating code that exists that people continue to live by.
One of the things that makes Wally unique, well, not unique, but very different from other popular movies, you know, traditional fiction has three different conceptions of conflict. And it's usually a character against him or herself, a character versus another character, or a character versus the environment. Most of the, you know, the popular sort of movies that we would think about typically go character versus character. There is a particular protagonist who represents the good and a particular antagonist who represents the evil. And in this particular case, it's very clear that this is set up as a character versus environment. Because it's the environment that is preventing the character or all of the characters from realizing their free will or from being able to live or even understanding that there are other environments or other opportunities or other choices that could be available to them. That said, there are still two characters who I think very clearly stand out as those who were either the ones who established the environment or who are critical in perpetuating it. The latter case being the robot character on the ship, Otto, who very clearly postured itself as being the preventer of the captain being able to perform what many of us would ordinarily consider captain's duties. The captain is reduced to a pure figurehead ceremonial entity, and he is clearly frustrated by it. I mean, that's one of the important things about, I think, you know, that relationship really captures a good dynamic of the challenges of, you know, who's in charge, the man or the machine. And then, of course, there's Shelby Forthright, who is the CEO of By and Large. He's only seen in a couple of, like, tiny snippets. It's very clear that, you know, he, just like we said before, he plays this presidential role. He's the global CEO. He only appears like three or four times. But he's the one who made two critical decisions that basically established the fate of the humans on board the Axiom, on board this space cruise ship. And so I look at him as kind of like being the real true villain of the movie, even though he's long, you know, presumed long dead. You know, the first being the establishment of the space cruise ships as a pseudo-utopia and encouraging all of mankind to get on them. But the second one is that when he makes the determination to give up on the cleanup job, and this is kind of important, what happened in the, it happens in the movie is that at some point during the cleanup job, long before we, you know, Wally is there, by and large, this CEO determines that the cleanup effort has failed, and by and large, the corporate headquarters just simply gets on their own cruise ship and departs and just leaves Earth. And there it is 700 years later, and we have this one robot who's still dutifully doing the cleanup job. But the other part of his decision was then to tell all of the other cruise ships never return to Earth. And this is hidden from the captain, it's hidden from everybody. It is given directly to the robot. there's a case where you have critical decisions about societies being not only vested in one person, but vested in a person who is unwilling to let anybody know, really, what he's doing. And that to me is, I took that as classic authoritarianism with a science fiction spin.
Yeah, in fact, it pays homage in a very important way to 2001, A Space Odyssey, because it's that paradox of programming that causes HAL to malfunction. And in fact, I'm very confident that image of the talking auto screen yes. is taken directly from 2001, because that's what you see of HAL when HAL's interacting with the humans.
I agree that these two figures, the Shelby Fortright and Otto, are indeed kind of the villains of the movie. And if we take it from a more organizational point of view or perspective, then you might actually say that the movie also kind of critiques leadership and bureaucracy, or the technostructure of organizations, as the villains of organizing.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? So if we take it to look at the Otto, it's actually a controlling structure that kind of oversees the operating procedures in the cruise ship. So it's a character that is maybe a futuristic representation of bureaucracy and which functions on artificial intelligence, and its primary objective is to not have the ship and also the humans specifically on the ship return to Earth. And this classified information, as you mentioned, is kind of, it steers all its other activities, and it becomes a goal in itself, which is I think a very, very known tendency that is attributed to bureaucracy in organizations, rules and procedures becoming goals in itself.
Of course, I have a lot to say. But I will not say a lot now, because I can elaborate as we go. But one thing that I want to put as a provocation is that, is this a problem of bureaucracy or a problem in bureaucracy? Because one way you can read that is basically problems of organizational memory about, or you can think about misalignment across procedures, misalignment of goals, you know. So, of course, we can see that the bureaucracy is just the one that is in the AI, and this is the real intention, and the other one is just a subterfuge, you know, this idea of going back to Earth is just like a movie that was left there or whatever. But the way you can read is also that there are competing programs of action, competing procedures, competing goals, competing ideas, and in a way both still exist in the system. You know, the video was there, there were pods being sent to Earth to look for life still, you know, that was still ongoing. And at the same time, it seems that encoded in the auto, which is, you know, the autopilot of the ship, there was a different procedural goal there. So now that then you have the conflict and the problem.
Well, that's a great conflict, in that, is it the bureaucracy that drives people to do that, or do people do that inside bureaucracy? I think it's hard to separate the two. It's good for us as organizational scientists to look at that, but I think those things get entangled. And I've seen many personal examples, but you also see them in literature, of people taking comfort in the bureaucracy, taking comfort in the bureaucratic rules, so they don't have to think, and they can just do what the rules say. And that was and I think that's a wonderful conflict between the captain, who said, "Oh, this is what we have to do. We have to rethink this, or this is we must override our programming, or override this, and return to Earth."
Yeah, and I think the other thing related to bureaucracy and this discussion also is, maybe not from a problem perspective, but more from a learning perspective. And I know, Pedro, that you are also you also worked with Paul Duguay and on the values of bureaucracy. Yeah, what can we learn actually from values and maybe pitfalls of bureaucracy, and how can we transfer that knowledge to, you know, artificial intelligence as a new and becoming probably an important structure in bureaucratic practices? I think that's also a question that the movie tries to raise in a way.
I want to hear what the others have to say. I don't have to cargo all the thing on the bureaucracy, but think about it. It's already a challenge for us. A lot of a standard ERP, you know, has a lot of protocols, rules, what information have to put on a, or even our relationship with interfaces that are online from, you know, our interface of the government, or even buying a ticket, what is encoded in the system that you need to provide? What is the acceptable workflows that go through, you know, imagine a factory, or how even you ask for reimbursement or something in your own university? All that is already encoded in the electronic systems. And of course, with AI, it just explodes. And if anything, I think that people like Stella Pachidi and Samer Farage, that has, you know, a paper on that, they show that, you know, with AI and algorithms, we can expect that bureaucracy, the bars become further hidden and less accessible and less maneuverable and less flexible, because there is less clarity of the principles behind how the system function, is less adjustable in a way. So, you know, it exactly, I agree with you, raise the point of how do we organize, and as we not only automatize, but digitalize at that level, how we should think about exceptions, for example, how we should think about when there are conflicts across goals, you know. So just another way to say that organizational theory matters, and we know we should be the ones participating in that discussion because it has real consequences.
Right, and it's really a question about this whole control and AI, you know, dominated world. What are we hard coding, lack of flexibility and rigidity? And an anecdote from my working days in a shipyard in the United States, when I got to the shipyard, I'm learning the rules and finding all these things written down in books and procedures and manuals and such. And my initial reaction was, well, when you see something in a procedure or a manual or an instruction, questioning is not what you do. Following it is what you do. And I remember having a conversation with one of the nuclear engineers about the procedures in a particular case. And he didn't come out and say this directly, but he said, tell me what you want to do, and I think we can modify the procedure. And this light bulb turned on because I realized, oh, they have to write something down, so they do, but you have the ability to go to the engineer or the person responsible for that part of the manual and say, this doesn't work for me, and here's why, and here's what I want to do, and how can we adapt the procedure? And I don't want to say or go on record as having said that's a license to steal, but it was certainly an opportunity to be more flexible because from then I realized, oh, I can tell the engineers what I want to do and bring them down and explain it to them or to talk to them over the phone, and I'll get an exception, or they'll write a procedure that allows me to deviate, but in a controlled manner, or in a manner that's not just whatever I want to do, that it has some coverage by the authorities. And I think WALL-E shows us this world where, can you even imagine having an argument with a computer, or in perhaps in our case, like an automatic teller machine or something where you have to fill out a form, as Pedro was talking about, for some attendance at a conference or something. You're not gonna have an argument with a web form. And yet here's the CEO that was arguing with Otto about what the mission of the ship was.
That assumes that we know or don't know that the thing at the other end of the phone line nowadays is an automated system. You know, those, they are getting very sophisticated now, where you are, you know, maybe if not already, maybe in the, you know, the near enough future, that we won't really be able to tell whether it's a person or something else on the other end of a phone line. And is that going to change our behavior? As it is, I think that there's you know, a certain amount of a rebellion, I don't know if that's the right word, that's been sort of building about how automation has been intruding into our lives in ways that we aren't yet accustomed to, or perhaps aren't totally comfortable with. We are still at the point of wanting to have the human in the loop, if you will. And so AI for some is sort of threatening that idea, and it's a little bit scary in some ways. And I sort of bring that up because, you know, based on like what you were saying, Ralph, about, you know, nuclear engineering, and I'm thinking about the situation that's depicted in WALL-E in both instances, both on the Earth and in the spaceship. And, you know, I mean, I know it's fiction. It's designed to be extreme because that's what makes it simple for people to grasp. But you wonder what kind of conflict might have occurred in real if we ever, say, reach the point where Ultra Stores and the whole totality of by and large was clearly threatening life on Earth. And what would it take for humankind to be so complicit as to voluntarily go on the same corporation's ships and leave Earth. And so, you know, in a similar way, when I think about, you know, advances in these technologies, there's going to be a backlash at some point. And what's the nature of that backlash going to be? And I'll give you an example of there's a beer commercial that came out earlier this year. It's almost, I'll bet you it's going to be kind of like a theme of the 2020s, where somebody puts a beer in front of another person who's busily doing nothing on a cell phone. And then the person gets off and the two go play pool together, and they describe the beer as the original social media.
Oh yeah, I remember. That's a fun commercial.
Yeah, and so, you know, there's, you know, one, sometimes I think we get so enamored with these new technologies as they're appearing because they do seem to have so much promise, only to recognize that it's just a phase. There's going to be, you know, complex adaptive behaviors are going to spring in ways we don't expect. It's going to be, it gets interesting.
So I have to jump in one thing, maybe just because I'm a pessimist, at least today, at least now. I think wouldn't take anything different, Tom, from what we already have, you know. When you have multi-billionaires talking about space exploration, and not only them as the possible solution for the problem, you know, same people that might not pay enough taxes or, I don't know, care about how their own employees are treated, you know, so on and so forth. I think we already live in that thing, and we might want to think otherwise, but we know that the planet is very much not in good shape, you know, and in a way, many of the discourses that emerge, at least the ones that sometimes get in the front page, is this kind of, you know, one single easy solution, which allows us to not have to confront that we are part, you know, we are the vectors, the reproducers, the enactment, the mechanism, whatever you want to call, through which this happens continuously. You know, not only single people, but, you know, collectively in the way the system is designed, we end up participating in that.
Yeah. Now, one of the challenges is on that, you know, to that very point is the challenge of simply defining the nature and the character of the problem. Because, you know, on the one hand, there's broad recognition that there is a problem. But to what extent can science describe the nature and the character of the problem, separating what's specifically being caused by humans versus what is specifically a natural phenomenon, you know, is one level of controversy. And then, of course, you have different ways in which people are dealing with the problem, which ranges from wholly agreeing, you know, just jumping on board with the scientists or jumping on board with the idea that we have a very significant problem that humans must cure, all the way to covering the ears, you know, just ignoring it, hoping it goes away. It's almost like what we were talking about in episode 45 when we were talking about whistleblowers. Just ignore it and don't acknowledge the problem. Don't pretend it just doesn't exist because at some point it's going to go away. They think it's sort of a thing. And so trying to pin down what really is the problem and what is the range of solutions and all that sort of thing. It's such an active conversation. It's hard to really know what to do.
Well, that's one of the things that makes the film fun is that because it paints these situations and images and challenges and paradoxes in such stark, cartoonish, literally, relief, it gives you a chance to think about them, as Tom and Pedro were just saying, that these are things that we probably take for granted. And in fact, Tom earlier mentioned the name of the ship, the Axiom. And I looked up the definition of Axiom. It's a statement accepted as true as the basis for argument or inference. And when you look at the humans on the movie, they're not thinking about, or they don't appear to be thinking about, the world in which they live. They're oblivious to that. They're just living in it. And the living conditions for the members of the or the people on the ship, because there's no crew, it's all robotic, it's status quo. There's people aren't developing. They're just getting soda and having these lounge chairs and talking about what they're going to do. And what I thought was really interesting was when we can talk about this later as an you know, change agents, but Wally comes in and he's trying to move up in line or in the seat. It's not, I don't know if you'd even call it seating, but on this mass transit car on which Ava is being taken to headquarters. And he can't get past this woman because of the way her hover lounge is situated. So he basically turns off her screen to get her attention. And all of a sudden, she sees the world differently because her screen got turned off, right? So you could make that argument literally that people should turn off their screens like the beer commercial. Or you can argue that Wally has caused this perturbation of this taken-for-granted world, and where all the human needs are met by robots and they don't have any motivation to go back and learn to Earth, they're just existing. He's removed all that, and now they're seeing the world perhaps maybe not as it is, but differently. And you can see it causes Mary and John to think differently and actually interact like in the beer commercial.
I recognize the scene you mentioned, Raph. I think it's, well, an amazing moment of awakening, which also happens with the captain, for instance. And these are these kind of moments that suddenly docile consumers experience a change in their life and are immediately willing to take on another perspective and fight for a good cause in a way. And that's kind of a strange narrative for me in the movie. If you look at the whole waste of the planet of Earth, of course, and that it's taken centuries to for the planet to recover, and that during our lifetime or during their lifetime they didn't find any solutions, and then, you know, based in this ship and a sudden awakening, removing their screens helps them to realize that there is, well, maybe some good in them, and also that they've got the power to change their own lives and also the whole situation of the planet. And that really, I think, refers also to the discussions that are going on right now on the sustainability of the our way of life, and well, the discussions that's been mentioned previously here. So will there be this kind of moment that we suddenly see how we can do things differently? That's kind of the narrative the movie provides. But then this is much more, of course, in real life, a discussion that's a very, maybe a more incremental change that's going on. And that's a very kind of different, real different perspective between, I think, the real world and this interesting movie.
It kind of reminds me of how, you know, we've sort of used different counter narratives that associated with trying to do something about it. There is the, you know, sort of the macro narratives, which basically say that the planet, you know, the planet Earth is in trouble. Here are all of the indicators. Governments or corporations, you know, typically I think the rose is trying to be pinned on governments more often than not. To actually do something. And then there's sort of the individual counter narratives, which are basically saying, like, you can make a difference if you do something yourself. And then the sum total of everybody doing their part would then create this change that would make things better. To what extent do either of those narratives align with the nature and the character of the problem is not always clear to me, because, you know, on the one hand, you can, you know, certainly there are things that individuals can do in order to improve or to bring attention to the problems that we're facing. But does the sum actually lead to the whole? What one does in one particular country may not necessarily influence another country that's doing twice as much damage as one, not doing the right thing and is causing more damage than the good that you're producing in your side. You know, it's a very, very complex problem, and I don't really know what right looks like in terms of trying to really ultimately bring about solutions. I don't know if I'm making myself clear. It's hard.
No, that's good. It's good, actually. I think it's this tension that we talk about between individual action and collective action. And one of the things that makes both of them, but particularly individual action, as Tom points out, difficult to evaluate in real time is as many times you just see, you don't see how the changes connect. You just see individual behavior. And as humans, we want to see patterns, you know, desperately, even when they don't exist and or that others don't see them. And so how do you take that individual action, as Tom talked about, and either not necessarily harness it, but see where it's going and what the trends might be. And particularly when it can differ between countries, it's really hard to say.
So one reflection on this whole issue of the individual, the level, countries, is that I'm not an expert in sustainability, but I think that in a way it's an issue, you know, that we have now, that in wrestling, you know, it's a terrible thing, but in wrestling is something that is a problem for, in principle, everyone, across class, race, ethnicity, national level, you know, it's global, literally. But I think that's, you know, it's maybe not intentional in the movie, but what I see as that is happening is that Earth is no more all across. We, of course, know that when and if and how we start to suffer real consequences of, you know, climate change and so on and so forth, it's not going to be equally distributed because, of course, different places, countries will have different resources to deal with it. But still, you know, eventually something that can reach out globally again, literally. But then one specific mass of people were able to escape. You know, I think that's another commentary I see. Is that we are challenged with something that is global and potentially can destroy civilization. And in the movie, I think is, you know, it's telling that seems to be a particular ethnicity, type of people, possibly class, and so on and so forth, that seems to have been able to still go on and be alive, you know, when Earth apparently is no longer able to hold us.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. You may not know this, but we really love receiving feedback from our listeners. So if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some of the best people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Riener, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Karamustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Pix Kraft, Timothy Paul, Willy Lechton Virta, and Gabriel Van Bunnen. And I apologize if I mispronounced your name. You are still the best and we love you so much. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website where a donations button will greet you. You can't miss it. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you next time for part 2 of the episode here on Talking About Organizations.